Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First package in the list is p11-kit, and this is the public key, PKCS, public key cryptography standard number 11. That's what this refers to, which itself is an API, essentially, for cryptography. It's all the common kind of cryptography algorithms are sort of covered within this PKCS number 11 standard, and P11-kit ensures that you can load the modules that you need in order to use all of these different kinds of cryptography. That's what P11-kit is. It ships with a bunch of header files and libraries so that developers can utilize it, and it does have one or two binaries. One is the P11-kit binary, and with that you can do things like list-modules, and it'll tell you what kind of module you have loaded right now, which P11-kit-trust is quite possibly what you'll have loaded by default, unless you've loaded more, you know, yourself, or I guess maybe there's a service out there that I'm not running that would have loaded a module, I'm not sure. Either way, you're likely to see a P11 module loaded, maybe to provide compatibility with some physical peripheral, like a key card type thing, or maybe an application that uses some kind of cryptography that needs to interface with the rest of the system. That's what P11-kit is used for. The next package in the list is the PAM-KRB5. This is a combination of PAM and Kerberos. I don't remember actually talking about PAM. I must have probably glossed over it at the time. I don't remember what I said, if I said anything. But yeah, so PAM stands for Pluggable Authentication Modules. This is what Linux uses to kind of centralize the question of authentication. So if a application on a Linux machine needs you to verify sort of who you are to it for any reason, whether you're requesting to sign on to another server somewhere, or whether you're asking to do something that you maybe shouldn't usually be able to do on the system, then instead of it coming up, you know, the developer of that application coming up with their own way of authenticating and storing and hashing a password and all these other things that they would have to do, they just plug into PAM and they ask PAM whether you are who you say you are. And PAM can check things like your login credentials. Did you provide, you know, is there a record of you having logged in? And if so, how long ago? Is there a, you know, using the system clock, is there a need for you to provide reinforcement that you are who you say you are, like another password entry, and so on. And assuming PAM says that everything's okay, then that application can continue. This module, or this package, provides the modular component that lets PAM understand Kerberos. Next package is PHP 7.4. I'm no expert in PHP. I don't program in it really ever. I did program in it a little bit at a job. We had some introductory web pages on the intranet that we had to do some fancy stuff on, and I just found that PHP was a good thing to use for that particular purpose, and I was pretty surprised at how easy it was to pick up. I mean, I was doing rudimentary stuff, but I mean, if you've programmed before, then you're familiar with concepts like functions and things like that that you can just that are built into a language that you can, or that are added onto a language that you can call and have them do cool things for you pretty simply. PHP has a lot of those. PHP, I mean, it is a popular programming language, and I've heard people complain about it for one reason or another, but I don't have the experience to either love or hate it. All I know is that it does seem to be a useful tool for certain things. And kind of one of the nice things about PHP is that it runs on the server, unlike, for instance, JavaScript. I mean, unless you're running Node, JavaScript runs on the the local client. So PHP is just something that you can script on the server, and it outputs HTML. It's pretty convenient. You do have to set things up a little bit. That's one reason I've never really embraced sort of the idea of PHP. Like there's not a barrier. I mean, there is a barrier to entry. Obviously, it's something that you have to learn, but it isn't quite as simple to sort of inherit a quick and easy development environment for as, say, Python or Lua or Java, where you can just start running it on your computer and have it do things. For PHP, I mean, it's very specific for HTML output. This is designed for web servers. This is the thing for that. It doesn't expect you to program in PHP for any other purpose. And for that reason, you pretty much have to be running a web server with a PHP module active in order to see like the output of your script. Now, on Slackware, that's relatively easy. We've run a web server already on this show. It's quite simple. It's sudo space sh space slash /etc/rc.httpd space start. But if you just run that, then your web server isn't aware, it hasn't loaded all of the configuration that you need for PHP to be recognized. So what you also need to do is sudo emacs /etc/httpd/httpd.conf, I think, or is that already configured? No, I think down at the bottom of that file, if I'm remembering correctly. No, I must be misremembering. No, I am. Okay. If it's not uncommented, I don't remember whether it's uncommented by default or not. You want to do a search for PHP, and you'll find a line that says uncomment the following line to enable PHP, and that's an include /etc/httpd/mod_php.conf. So if that's not uncommented, uncomment that, and then as you might expect, you need to go into mod_php.conf and make a couple of changes in the configuration. Sudo emacs /etc/httpd/mod_php.conf. You want to make sure that files ending for in this case, I'm gonna go a little bit over what really needs to happen, and it's clearly documented, so don't worry too much about it. It says tell Apache to feed all PHP, you know, anything .php files through PHP. So if you're going to name your files index.php, you know, hello.php, dice.php, whatever your file is going to be called, if you're going to end it in PHP, then this is a safe one to uncomment if it's not already uncommented, because that just detects any file ending in .php and treats it as a PHP file. That's kind of normal, what you would expect. Now, you could also just, if you want a little bit of more flexibility, you can tell Apache to feed all .php and .html files and .htm files through PHP as well. That's a bit over the top, because you probably don't need to run every HTML file through PHP. Like if you could, you'd probably say, well, only run the PHP file, only run the HTML files that have PHP in them through PHP, but that's not the option here. I'm going to uncomment both personally, because that way I can have both. But on a real web server, you would probably just run PHP files through PHP. Okay, so now that that's enabled, I guess we could restart httpd just to make sure. Sudo sh /etc/rc.d/rc.httpd/restart, and that makes sure that it detects that new configuration option. And now we could go into our web root, which is I'll do a sudo emacs /var/www/htdocs/index.html. So I'm just reusing this one-liner here that says it works. I'm just going to embed some PHP into that. So to embed PHP into an HTML document, you can open the PHP tag with a less than symbol ?PHP. And then use one of the keywords of PHP, for instance, echo just like in Bash, echo, space, single quote. You could do, for instance, less than P, greater than hello world, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamamation mark, why not? And then less than slash P, greater than symbol, single quotation mark, semicolon. Now we've got, if I save that and go to Firefox and type in localhost, I've got it works. And then hello world with lots of exclamation marks after it. You're writing PHP. As I say, though, PHP does have quite a few modules. I mean, it's got like if and then statements. It's got for loops. It's got all the stuff that you would expect. And frankly, a lot of the stuff that you'd be used to if you're even a basic rudimentary Bash user. If you've done Bash scripts, then you're probably aware of some of those kinds of conventions of programming. Now, if you're a intermediate to an advanced Bash programmer, then you might also understand that you can create functions within Bash, and they can do anything, right? You could do, like, you could define a function to print, I don't know, your username and IP address or something. And then every time you call that function, it does the same thing. It does the same action. It follows the same instructions. And PHP has a bunch of those as well. And you can learn all about them on the PHP, official site. But I mean, there are string functions, there are math functions, regex functions, and so on. So you can do things like, I don't know, simple one would be echo quote, but we'll get a little bit fancy with the HTML here. So we're going to do a single quote, P tag, and then we'll do a strong tag, close quote, and then I'm going to do dot, and this is concatenating. So I'm echoing something, but the dot after the quoted text that I want to echo, the dot means to concatenate whatever comes after it with what came before it. And in this case, I'll just do pi, P-I, parentheses, parentheses, and then a dot, and then a single quote, and I'll close that strong tag, I'll close that P tag, I'll close the single quote, and I'll do a semicolon. Oh, and I forgot to close the PHP tag, didn't I? Yeah, question mark, greater than symbol at the very end. So the opening of a PHP tag is less than question mark PHP, and then the PHP that you want to write. And then at the end, it's question mark, greater than. That closes the PHP block. And that's all going within the body of this it works thing. So if I go to Firefox now and reload this page, I have it works, hello world, exclamation, exclamation, exclamation. And then under that, in its own paragraph with bold text, 3.14159265358988. So we just got the value of pi more or less for free. I think there's a random, let's add another line here. We'll do echo, let's just do echo rand parentheses zero, comma, no, actually let's do 1, 20 and then semicolon, close parentheses and semicolon. I think that's the correct syntax. We'll reload here and see what we get. Yeah, there we go, 4. I got a 4 after my pi and after my hello world. So now I'm going to reload it again, and now I have 15. Reload again, now I have 2, and so on. So you get the idea. We're creating dynamic content in a way. I mean, you go to this page, and every time you go to the page, you have a different number. And so in a way, you've kind of written a really, really simple dice rolling app in PHP now. That also wishes you a hello world and tells you the value of pi for no good reason. But that's the kind of thing you can do. And obviously there's a lot more you can do. There are string functions and loops. So you can modify things. You can set variables. I guess that would be a handy thing to do. Let's do $name equals quote clatu close quote semicolon. And then we'll do echo $name. Semicolon. See if that works. I think it should. I don't think I'm forgetting syntax there. Reload. Yeah, and there's, I failed because I'm not using the HTML tags. The random numbers are generating right up against my name. 17 Clatu, 6 Clatu, 2 Clatu. That's a little bit weird. And I could fix that just by, including quote P tag, close quote, dot, $name, dot, quote, close that P tag. And I guess I should probably do the same thing around the random thing, but that sounds like work. I'm going to just skip that. And now I'll do a reload. And yeah, now I've got the random number on its own line and then my name on the final line. That's it, really. I mean, and there are lots of different ways. It's pretty flexible in terms of how you implement your PHP. You could write your entire website within PHP, you know, like index.php, and just have a bunch of PHP sort of outputting HTML, and then just that could be your web page. Or you can do it this way, which I've been doing, which is to have an HTML file and then just embed the PHP into it when you need that PHP. I've seen it done both ways. I don't know if there's a best practice. I think it probably depends on scale. Like, what do you need PHP to do for you? How much PHP do you intend to use? I think it just kind of depends. Now, because PHP is such a popular programming language, it's been around for ages. There are the basic modules, which I've already kind of sort of talked about, like, you know, string modules and the ability to make variables and math modules and functions is what I'm trying to say. If, else, else if, switches, loops, and arrays, and so on. But there are also, you know, entire other modules for PHP or functions. For instance, I mean, famously, I think you can control MySQL through PHP. There are modules. I keep saying modules like it's Python. There are functions for that. So that's a classic. I mean, PHP MyAdmin, that was written in PHP. That's why it's called PHP MyAdmin. And PHP is, I mean, still very, very, very popular. I mean, entire web applications are written in PHP, WordPress and Nextcloud leap immediately to mind, but I'm sure there's a bunch of others that I'm not thinking of right now. So yeah, PHP is a very powerful language. It is the way to make a website dynamic and to really make a website and application. And I think in some ways that was maybe not the earliest, but I mean certainly an early means of making the web more like an application rather than just a big textbook. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty fun. You should check it out. I mean, like I say, I don't know if it is the easiest thing, it's not the most natural thing to fall into, because you do have to run the web server. You have to have that web server configured to run PHP or rather to process certain files through PHP. But it's all here on Slack, where all you have to do is uncomment the bits in httpd.conf. Potentially, that might have been uncommented already. I forget whether I had to uncomment that manually, and the one in modphp.conf. So pretty simple to get up and running on Slackware with PHP, and then you just start editing files and playing around with PHP, and you get really cool output. Next package is PinEntry. This is a library, I believe, from the GPG project, if I'm remembering correctly. It's a package that provides several different dialog boxes for pin entry or passphrase entry dialog. So you might see these, like if you're starting a GPG agent, or if you are running an application that requires a password entry and it makes a call to something in PinEntry, you'll see that. It can be a little bit confusing sometimes because, I really wish that there were more sort of standardized kind of like, this is exactly the interface we use for this, especially when inputting sensitive information. I just think that consistency is very valuable. And I do have to say that I've got a KDE dialog that comes up and asks me for a password. And then I've also got this PinEntry thing that comes up and asks me for a password. And if I were trying to explain to someone when it's safe to enter a password, when some window mysteriously pops up on your computer, I would love to be able to point to just one thing and say that you're an authentic password prompt from this desktop, this is what that looks like. But I guess, you know, there are lots of different libraries, and I just kind of, I don't know, I wish, just like file choosers, I wish there was some kind of layer of abstraction where it's just like, this is what the desktop dialogue entries look like. It doesn't matter whether it's being invoked by Zenity, or KDE or GTK or whatever. And I know that's not entirely possible. I mean, GTK and Qt are two completely different things, but it would just be nice if there was some kind of layer of abstraction where the admin could say, this is the absolute must-have theme for these components that I want my users to be able to sort of get used to. Okay, with that, let's take a coffee break. We'll come back, we'll take some listener feedback, and finish up the show. Okay, coffee in hands, and boy is it appreciated today. It's quite cold here in New Zealand. It is like, I don't know, -2 or something. Very, very cold, Celsius. And I've got listener feedback, unrelated to the cold. But I do have some interesting listener feedback. One from Norist on Mastodon. Norist says, here's a reason to output in-map results to XML. I run something like this, so I have an up-to-date list of services on my network. And then Norist links to the inmap.org website where they have an article, or actually an ebook, actually. And within this ebook, there's a section on creating HTML reports. And you can do that really easily if you go out to XML first, which completely makes sense now that I think about it. Norist later provided the exact command to use, inmap-capital F192.168.10.1-254, for instance, 192.168.11.1-254-OX, capital X for the XML output, and then scan.xml. Okay, so now the network has been scanned. Two different subnets, they've been scanned from host to host, start to finish. Then pipe that output, scan.xml, through XSLT proc, which I think we've talked about before, XSLT proc space scan.xml-o inmap.html, and you get a nice, pretty HTML report that you can view with your favorite HTML viewer, or turn into an EPUB to take with you on the train, who knows. Like, whatever you want to do, HTML is a great format. So that's a really, really good point. And I guess in a weird way, I'd forgotten momentarily that XML was a really good interchange format, or I should say is a really good interchange format. Like, that's not all it is. Like I say, I use XML in real life all the time for like DocBook and that sort of thing. But beyond that, like, XML is just a really, really great kind of all-inclusive format. Yes, it's verbose to look at, but there are so many great processing tools out there that can go from XML to something else. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks, Norist, for that feedback. More feedback. This one from Deep Geek. And Deep Geek is emailing in about two terminal emulators that run, get this, in the Linux terminal. Wait, what? Terminal emulators that run in the Linux terminal? Yes, that is correct. And he says, and these are his words now, my voice, his words, and you might ask yourself, why bother? You are already using the Linux terminal. But here is the rub. This adds features to the Linux terminal. My biggest pet peeve has been the lack of TrueType font support, but each of these programs, both FBTerm and KMSCon, support TrueType fonts. So my favorite font is called 3270 Nerd Font. This is a font that was used on IBM mainframe terminals, like the two I spent several years using, the IBM 3277 and the IBM 3290. The fact that it is a nerd font means that it has some icons, like a folder icon and a note icon, which the biggest replacement, EXA, can make use of to make beautiful and nostalgic imitation of an old computer while retaining some modern features. I don't spend all my time in a terminal, but I do spend a lot of time there. Both of these programs also have the ability to create a new screen with hotkeys, switch between several virtual sessions. Both have a built-in pager, so rerunning a program and piping it out, its output to less isn't needed anymore because, again, the pager is built in. FBTerm supports GPM mouse. KMSCon can be a Getty replacement. It's really interesting stuff. The only thing these things can't do is start an X or a Wayland session, but I am seriously tempted to go back to using CDM, Console Display Manager, so I can actually have my system work in a hybrid way with or without graphics. By the way, the thing about X and Wayland sessions, it also affects the Linux 2 browser. So in Linux 2, you can have the regular Linux console with inline graphics and using a GPM-driven mouse, or kick it off from X11 and use the X11 mouse drivers, but no GPM mouse for KMSCon, compared with Lynx, which has mouse support only in an X term. So GPM is a driver, in case you don't know, dear listener, is a driver within Linux that, I mean, Slackware has it, and there's even a startup script for it, just in case you want it. It's /etc/rc.d/rc.gpm-sample. And this activates this driver, and the driver makes your mouse work in a console. Like, not the Linux terminal. I mean, the Linux terminal, you know, pretty much, like, at least modern terminal emulators, like Console and GNOME and GNOME Terminal, whatever, they already respond to your mouse in many ways. Like, I can select things. I think I could probably even, I think I can hover over URLs and right-click and open link or copy link or whatever, open a certain file in File Manager, you know, like all kinds of different things. So Console already does that, but if you were, for instance, booting Slackware and you didn't launch a graphics server, so you had no graphics, you had no GUI, you were just at a console, like a terminal, you know, like a console, then with the GPM mouse driver, you can use your mouse to do some things. I haven't used it in a long time, so I don't exactly, I know you can click, I know you can select, I feel like you can middle click to paste, but I could be making that up. I haven't used GPM in a while, but it is pretty cool, and that's what DB is talking about there. And yeah, so this is really interesting, and I think I've used FBTerm without really realizing what it was or why I had to use it. I forget what it was. I think it was to render a graphic or something on a computer that had no graphic server. I believe that's correct. I believe it was FBTerm that I used for that. I could be misremembering. It could have been some other FB, but I feel like it was FBTerm. Either way, These are fascinating things to kind of boost your Linux experience on something that's not running a graphics server. And, you know, in some ways, you kind of think, well, that's just not realistic. People don't really do that anymore. There's no need for it. Like, who's really running a computer without a graphics server these days? You might be on a server, maybe. But you might not be. You may, you know, that server might still have a graphics server running on it that you VNC into and control, you know, when you need to, or if you ever need to, or that you might choose to do, you know, at some point in the future, if you think, oh, I would really just love to see, you know, the file system in this certain view, and you just VNC over into it. So, I mean, it's becoming less and less common, I think, to run into a computer that just has no graphics server running. And yet, if you wanted to do that for some reason, maybe on a very small device, like a Raspberry Pi, from, you know, years and years ago, or from a very, very old computer, these could really make a remarkable improvement on your experience, FBTerm or KMSCon. I mean, they have, you know, they elevate the experience to certainly nothing like a graphics server, really, but they do give you a lot of flexibility that you wouldn't have otherwise on just a normal, like, text-only kind of console. So I think they're worth looking into if you want to really, really boost your free graphic server experience. So yeah, try them out. FBTerm, KMSCon. They're both in Slack builds. Okay, next package in the list here is POPA 3D, which is the Post Office Protocol A3D. I don't know what the A and the 3 stand for. D is daemon or demon. And this is a little POP 3 daemon, and I say little complimentarily, is that a word? It describes itself as a tiny POP 3 daemon. So, I mean, it is aware. One of its design goals is to be very, very small and do only what is necessary to accomplish the exact stated goals of POP 3. And in fact, all it does is retrieve email. So if you want users to be able to log into your server over the POP3, you know, using the POP3 protocol and retrieve email on that system that is meant for them, that's what this does. That's what POPA 3D. That's what that does. It is the default POP3 server, really. I mean, if you really think about it, because if you look in /etc/inetd.conf, this is where inet services are started on Slackware, all the, you know, the networking services, and the default entry in here, I mean, it's commented out, but you're meant to go in here and uncomment the services that you want to start. The one for Post Office Protocol version 3 server is POP3, and it's user sbin POPA3D. That's the one it starts. It starts IMAPD for the IMAP service, but for POP3, that's what it defaults to. This is designed to be tiny, so it does not handle like virtual domains, that sort of thing. Like it is exactly a POP3 server for that computer. The computer that it is running on is the computer it is a POP3 daemon for. It has no knowledge, at least not yet. I mean, it says it's in development, but currently it has no knowledge of a server, you know, of other domains being hosted on a server. It will only serve the host and domain that it is installed upon. So that's something to bear in mind. It's not designed to be sort of the big POP3 daemon that you're running, you know, to provide email accounts for all the different websites that you're hosting. That's not going to happen. This is POP3 for the computer it's running on, and that's all. On a somewhat related note, the next package is PostFix. PostFix is a replacement for SendMail. SendMail, I guess, was the big mail application for, you know, ages, decades, probably centuries. I don't know. SendMail, it was like the thing that you used to make mail work on a computer for a very long time, apparently. I don't know. PostFix is what that's the only one I've ever used. It's definitely my favorite. I mean, I think I did look into trying to figure out SendMail at one point. Didn't love it. Looked at a couple of other systems, but I feel like I was always confused at what component I actually needed, and it just felt like PostFix was very frequently the thing that I was looking for when I was looking for a thing. And by that I mean, like, someone would ask me, hey, you know, this server needs a mail server set up for some reason. And very frequently that was because there's some application running on that server that needs access, or rather the ability to send email to help people retrieve password reminders, or you know, to complete a registration step or something like that. So it was very frequently a send-only mail server. Didn't even have to worry about incoming mail, relaying mail, stuff like that. Didn't matter. This was just going to send out from a specific domain. And PostFix just seemed to always be the easy one to set up for that. If you go to postfix.org and go to the configuration section, they have a fantastic write-up on how to configure PostFix and all the different variables involved and what you need to know. I say fantastic, but I'm gonna do a caveat here of email servers and, you know, server configuration in general, Linux configuration, computers. It's not easy. There's a lot of stuff that you need to know before you start reading even fantastic documentation on a very, very complex system. And so the PostFix documentation, it's not going to teach you everything about email configuration. It'll tell you, like, it explains, for instance, look at this, what domain name to use in outbound email. The My Origin parameter specifies the domain that appears in mail that is posted on this machine. The default is to use the local machine name, or $ my host name, which defaults to the name of the machine. Unless you are running a really small site, you probably want to change that into $ my domain, which defaults to the parent domain of the machine name. And you get sentences like that, in other words. And maybe that made sense to you. It does make sense to me, but I remember a day when that didn't make sense to me. Like, I read it, I kind of understood, like, the gist, but, like, what are they talking about? Especially phrases like, the default is to use the local machine name, which defaults to the name of the machine. Unless you are running a really small site, you probably want to change that to my domain, which defaults to the parent domain of the machine name. Like, what? Like, that's just, that doesn't make sense. There are better ways to say that. And there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of stuff like that in this this write-up. And yet, like, even having sort of said that, like, it is a fantastic write-up. Like, this is really, really good. But you do have to know what sort of, like, not the literal variables, that's what this is going to explain to you, but the real world variables, or the components, let's call them that. What components are in play? What even is PostFix? Well, PostFix is, like I say, it's a mail server. So it has the ability to send email and to accept email, which is a unique thing. And neither of it has anything, well, I mean, it has vaguely something, but neither of these things are not like what Pop A3D are providing. Like, Pop A3D is, you know, the package we just talked about. That's providing a client connection to retrieve email that is now stored on a machine. PostFix is how that email got onto the machine in the first place. So PostFix is just one little part in the much, much larger email puzzle, but it's one of the starting points, unless you're going to just use SendMail, in which case, well, we're not talking about that. But, like, if you were to just use SendMail, then you're just using SendMail, not a big deal. But PostFix, that's kind of the starting point. You know, if you want a robust mail system on a server, PostFix is the place to go. And certainly, for me, if you want an email sending service, I still vote PostFix. And that might be silly, maybe just letting SendMail do its thing on your computer. Maybe that's the reasonable choice, because it's already there. Who knows? I just don't know SendMail myself. I know PostFix. So that's what I default to when someone says, hey, I'm running this container, it wants to do some stuff with, like, sending emails out. How do I do that? I just go for PostFix, install that, and just set it to just being a sending client, you know, sending out emails and accepting none. It's a brilliant, brilliant solution. Super easy. But you could experiment around to make it a full-fledged email server as well. Just, you know, all of the usual warnings apply. Don't accept and allow relaying emails to thousands of people. You will get yourself onto all kinds of block lists. So do be careful when you're doing an email server that is going to be public facing. All right, next up is PPP, which is the point-to-point protocol. This is a protocol for sending data over serial links. This is the protocol that, you know, thousands and millions of people used to use to connect to the internet with their modem. That's what this would do, is negotiate a connection with the remote host and establish a network between the two points, point-to-point protocol. You can legitimately use it still today, as long as you have an ISP with a phone number that you can dial, you know, through a modem. Like an internet provider running a PPP daemon for you to connect to. And the easiest way to do that is to run user sbin ppp setup, all one string PPP setup. And that brings up a nice incurses interface that prompts you for a phone number. There's a bunch of caveats in there about you have to use some prefix that they don't actually explain, ATD, don't know what that is, ATD and then T and then the phone number, 1234567, right? Yeah. But in the US, for instance, it would be ATDT star 70 comma. The comma turns off call waiting or something. 1234567 or whatever your phone number, the phone number of the thing that you're dialing into would be. You could also, I guess, just run the PPPD daemon on, I guess that's redundant, right? I should just say you can run PPPD on Slackware and I guess set up your own internet. I just don't know how to do that. So I did try. I ran PPPD in a virtual machine and it basically took over my terminal, which I had not expected it to do at all. And eventually I decided that running a PPP daemon just as a novelty was not truly worth my time. And so I bailed out. But there it is. It is available on Slackware. If you need PPP connectivity, that's the daemon that you're going to look to for that purpose. And if you don't want to run the daemon, then you can just use PPP setup and it'll help you out. Next up is Procmail, and this is a fantastic little application. Procmail is a filtering system, or I guess a mail processing. That's what Procmail, because it is processing mail or process mail, whatever. Mail processing and delivery, you can kind of think of it as the mail room for PostFix, or I guess for whatever mail server you happen to be running. I'm assuming it's PostFix. And the idea is that you're going to send the big, just the raw data of email that you have received to Procmail, and then you set up lots of Procmail rules and filters, and you tell, you know, and you figure out where all of that email, all of that bulk data dump, where all of that gets actually sent to on the system. I don't know how it's done on other mail servers, but for PostFix, you just go into your main.cf configuration file, which is in /etc/postfix/main.cf, and you put mailbox_command equals /wherever postmail is, which procmail, user bin procmail, -a space quote $ extension close quote reload post fix, and then all of your mail that you get with post fix gets forwarded to Procmail for filtering and then delivery, you know, after the filtering process. Filters in Procmail are called recipes, or at least that's what everyone online calls them. I think that's an official term. The recipe is sort of a block of text that starts with any kind of special flags you want to use for this recipe, and those are all documented in the Procmail documentation and certainly lots of examples online. To be perfectly honest, a lot of the recipes I've ever used have just been things that I've stolen from other people's configuration files, sort of recipe books, if you will, online. So after the options, then you put on each line, one per line, you put the kinds of conditions you want to filter against. And then from there, you know, after all the conditions, then you place exactly the exact action that you want, one action that you want Procmail to then take, which could be anything from sending the email to DevNull because it was detected as spam, or it could be, or a virus, or it could be, you know, placing it into a specific mail directory. I don't think there's much use at this point in going too deep into Procmail because I'm not really sure what the status of Procmail is. Procmail.org does exist, but if you, at least today and apparently for a while, if you go to Procmail.org, you get just an empty JSON file, like a data dump in JSON format of nothing. It's really bizarre. It's like someone's got like a do nothing API running there, like an endpoint or something. I don't know what would cause just an empty JSON to be, but yeah, go to procmail.org. You'll see it's a completely empty page. So I don't know if one has to assume that procmail is dead or if it's just in a state of flux, not sure. There are all alternatives, however, including MailDrop, which you can find at courier-MTA, as in mail transfer agent, .org/MailDrop. Both with MailDrop and Procmail, you do need to learn the language of the recipes. I don't know if MailDrop uses something that's the same as Procmail. Like I say, I never really learned Procmail, to be honest. I just stole other people's work off of the internet, and that usually served me quite well, because I was never doing anything super fancy with mail filtering on any of the systems I ever set up. But that's what Procmail is. Check out MailDrop, because yeah, I'm not really too sure about what Procmail is doing these days. Next on the list is ProFTPD. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking what I was thinking. Why would you want to run an FTP server in 2024? Well, there are a couple of different reasons, I think. One is because maybe you don't want to run an HTTP server. That's a reason. FTP is, you know, generally a little bit more of it's a different experience. If you've never been on an FTP server, you're on the internet, or you can be. I mean, you know, you could also just run an FTP server locally. But I mean, an FTP server classically it's on the internet, but instead of opening a web browser to access that site, you open an FTP client. What's an FTP client? Well, it's an application that talks FTP. Like, that's all it is. Now, the interesting thing about FTP is that it doesn't assume graphics at all. I mean, it really assumes that you just want files, which interestingly is what a web server does. It's just, instead of just giving you a file, a web server opens that file in your web browser and shows you the contents. Oftentimes it has to do a lot of interpretation to do that. Like, if it's showing you HTML, it's not really showing you the HTML code. It's showing you a rendering of the HTML code. If it's showing you a movie, it's not showing you the movie. It's opening some kind of media player, or rather, yeah, your browser opens a media player and then plays the file for you. FTP doesn't do that. It just shows you the files. It's like, look, there's a text file here, there's an HTML file here, there's an MKV file here, and you can drag that file off of the FTP server onto your desktop and then look at that file yourself in whatever application you deem appropriate. If it's an MKV, maybe you'll play it in VLC. Maybe you'll play it in Xine or Zine, or however you say that, X-I-N-E, or maybe in Dragon. If it's a text file, maybe you'll open it in Emacs. Maybe you'll open it in whatever other text editors there are, Kate, Kwrite, whatever. So it's kind of up to you, and there's a certain efficiency to that. And I know that there are other ways to have that experience. I mean, like SFTP, first of all, that's a really good way to do that. And probably arguably that might be the best way to do this. Like, don't run an FTP server, just have SSH going and let people access the files that you want them to have access to over SFTP. It's really can be as simple as that. And yet, ProFTPD has a bunch of modern features, like a .ftp access file, which acts a bit like a .ht access file. It kind of restricts what people, or how a local directory behaves for people. It's got, you know, it disables old FTP defaults that were probably fine for the internet a long time ago, but probably wouldn't be such a great idea for the internet today. So it's a modern implementation of this FTP tradition, and I don't know how much it's been stress tested. I don't know if I would run an FTP server for the big wide internet necessarily without really thinking it through. But if you did want to use, if you wanted to run an FTP server, ProFTPD is definitely an option. It's one thing that you could consider running, and it's kind of all available, as you might expect, on Slackware, with a bunch of default configuration files. So there's first of all, a Etsy/etsy/proftpd.conf where you can go and sort of review the settings. The settings have things that'll work. A home directory called FTP, which if you'll look in your slash home directory, there is an FTP folder there, and you may not have noticed that before. You may have noticed it. You may have noticed, you know, wondered why it was there. This is one of the reasons why it's there. You can turn on anonymous FTP usage, like if you don't have to go through the whole, like, where a user is coming from and how are they being registered, that sort of thing. You can do an anonymous FTP configuration by going into /etsy/ftp users and just commenting out the FTP line there. And then last but not least, you have to go into your inetd.conf file and find in there the pro FTP server line, or as it calls itself, professional file transfer protocol FTP server. And you'll see the pro FTPD command listed at the end of that line. So you'd want to uncomment that and then reboot your machine, or there are instructions at the top of that file on how to send an interrupt signal to inetd. I didn't bother doing that. I just rebooted. And then in theory, you're running an FTP server. But wait, there's one thing that you might not have active on your machine, and that would be inetd. If you're not starting that by default, then you do need to start that. So you would want to do sudo chmod plus x /etsy/rc.d/rc.inetd. Okay, now in theory, well, and then, so now that you've enabled that, you either have to reboot or you could do sudo sh /etsy/rc.d/rc.inetd /start. You get a message that you're now running this daemon, and because you've uncommented the FTP, the pro FTP line in your inetd.conf, now you can trust that that has been launched or started. Okay, so now everything should work, right? Okay, so over on your client machine, not the one that you've just started FTP on, let's say that's a Slackware machine as well, or a Linux machine, with NCFTP installed. I mean, Slackware, that's why I chose Slackware initially, because that would have NCFTP already installed. We've talked about it in an earlier episode. If it's another Linux box, then just install NCFTP. If it doesn't have it, probably doesn't. NCFTP-U for user FTP, or actually you can do anonymous as well, because in the proftpd.conf, anonymous is aliased to FTP. And then space, and then the address of the FTP server. So in my case, it's a virtual machine, 192.168.122.82. Hit return, login incorrect. Oh, that's weird. Okay, so -u anonymous, login incorrect. -u FTP -p FTP, like a password maybe? No, nothing will work. The problem is if you look at the logs on your FTP server, you'll notice that, and I'm going through it this way because it's not, I couldn't find this documented anywhere. But if you look at the logs, it tells you that there's an invalid shell set, and that is /bin/false. Well, that doesn't exist. That's not real. That's not a shell. And that's why the FTP login is failing. So you need to do something like sudo change shell, or chsh, space, and then change it to some valid shell. Now, interestingly, I got an error when I changed it to bash, because even though I typed in /bin/bash, it substituted /user/bin/bash for change shell. And that shell isn't listed in /etc/shells, so it came up as an invalid shell. So you can either add /usr/bin/bash to etc shells, or you can do what I did and just use /bin/tcsh, because tcsh is a perfectly fine shell. Or you could do bin ash, you know, anything that's actually in bin and is not aliased. All right, so, oh, and that chain shell, is on the server running the pro FTPD. You're setting the shell of your FTP user over on the server. Okay, so once that's fixed, then if you use on your client /nctp /u /ftp or anonymous space 192.168.122.82 or whatever your FTP server is running on. Then you hit return and suddenly you're actually connected, logging in. Anonymous access granted, restrictions apply. If I do an LS, I get an empty, I get nothing, because there's probably, to be fair, nothing on, nothing in the FTP user folder. So I'm going to do a sudo echo hello world and redirect that to /home. This is on the server again. /home/ftp hello.txt. Oh, and that is not permitted? Why would that not be permitted? I did a sudo. Okay, how about if I just su as FTP? No, I can't do that. Sudo bash, and now change into home FTP. How about that? Okay, echo, quote, hello world, redirect to hello.txt. There we go. Now, that's probably not going to be readable. Yeah, that's owned by root, so I'm going to chmod that to 775 hello.txt. Now that, oh, and I guess, actually, I should chone it. Yeah, that's what I should do. I should chone to FTP. I don't know what their group is, but can I just do chone FTP? No. Oh, yes, I can. Yeah, okay. So now if I look at this, it's owned by FTP and it is readable by FTP. So I'll go back over to my little client here, ls, there's hello world. If I do a cat hello.txt, there's hello world. So yeah, that's working. So that's running an FTP server in the modern age. Whether or not that's a really good idea or not, I don't really know. I haven't run an FTP server, you know, in real life for a bunch of people. I've fired one up just for quick access. And I think that is, in a way, did I mention this one? You know, kind of an example of why this could be a good option, because there are FTP clients out there that may or may not be a little bit easier for some people to kind of understand, as opposed to SSH, for instance. I mean, on a Linux box, who cares? Just SSH in your file manager to the computer, and you get a file view. Anybody can understand. It's super easy. Drag and drop. Very simple. If you're just local, you know, local network, you just want to share a file. That's a really easy solution. But if you've got someone who's on Mac or Windows and they're not really used to these concepts, it could be that a nice little FTP client could be just sort of like the easy way to have a shared file location with other users just on your local network. And as I say, pro FTPD, that could be the solution for that kind of situation. Okay, next up is PSSH. This is parallel SSH. It's very cool. It's apparently just like a Python wrapper script or something, which I didn't know. But you can SSH into multiple machines at once and send them all commands. Is this the best way to admin your computer? Arguably not. There's another Python wrapper, if I may call it that, called Ansible, that does essentially the same thing, but it does it programmatically. You define actions that you want the configuration manager to take on a machine. If it isn't already in that state, it does the things that you have defined to bring it to a certain state. That's probably the correct and safe way to do mass, you know, actions on a bunch of machines. But PSSH, first of all, existed before anything like that existed, as far as I recall. And secondly, like, sometimes you do just need to do a thing on lots of computers. And that's what PSSH does for you. It's really, really cool. I've seen it in action, and it is. It's legitimately very cool. And, you know, I mean, especially if this is in a test environment and you're just, you know, the exact state of all your machines, and you're going in to do, you know, maybe to add a configuration file or to add test files to lots of machines so that you can then run your scraper against all the different machines or something like that, then PSSH is a really nice really just quick way to make something happen on a bunch of machines. Running PSSH is a little different than running just straight SSH, because you are, after all, dealing with a bunch of different machines. So the bare minimum that you need is a hosts file, which is simply a text file with every, you know, a host name or IP address, one per line. So in my host file, I've got two virtual machines that are running. One is a Red Hat machine, one is a Slackware machine, and they both have the username bogus on it, B-O-G-U-S. Same password for both, luckily, bogus123. So that's my host, but my host file just has 192.168.122.82, and then a new line, 192.168.122.83. Those are the two hosts in the host file. So now with PSSH, I can do PSSH --hosts and then point it to my hosts file, --user bogus, and then it's --A for ask to be asked for a password. I think it's like --ask pass. Yeah, --ask pass, all one string. And then single quote echo, double quote hello world, close quote redirect voila.txt, close single quote. So that has been the PSSH command, --hosts, pointing it to a hosts file, which in my case, hosts.txt, --user bogus, that's a user that exists on all of the target machines you are SSHing into. Then --ask pass and the command that you want to run. If it's a very elaborate command, you might want to you'll want to quote it. So that's what I've got. If I hit return, I am asked for a password. Type in my password, bogus123. Again, that only works because that is true for all of the users on these machines, on these virtual machines. If that wasn't true, and hopefully it isn't true, that would fail because you're just entering a password. I mean, I guess maybe you could do it. Well, maybe it would ask you for a separate password for each host. I don't think so. Really, obviously, the ideal would be that you would have SSH keys on your target systems. That's really, really how you would want to do it. I'm doing it this bad way because it's just a demo. Okay, so it's just run. It has reported success. And if there's a failure, it tells you there's a failure. But this was a success. And if I SSH into my virtual machine normally, then I can do an ls in my home directory. Here's a bunch of nonsense. There it is. Voila.txt. If I do a cat on voila.txt, sure enough, there's the phrase hello world. And that's everything. Those are all the P's in the in section. We're out of the P section, which is nice because now we're into the R section. I mean, we're still in the in folder, so we're still in networking. We still have quite a ways to go for that. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.